This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. NASCAR took last Sunday off for Easter, but two Sundays ago, fans tuned into an event that looked and sounded very much like the real thing. Sort of. As computer-generated fans cheered, the anthem was sung by the very real-life actress Rita Wilson, recently recovered from COVID-19, while a computer-generated U.S. flag fluttered high above a computer-generated Bristol Motor Speedway.
Whose broad stripes and bright stars?
This is the iRacing Pro Series, where real NASCAR drivers follow the real NASCAR schedule as they race each other on virtual recreations of real-life tracks. And while other sports leagues have been struggling to keep fans engaged, NASCAR, whose ratings for real-world events have dipped in recent years, has been drawing 1 million viewers a week to TV broadcasts of these new virtual races. So what's it like being a real driver in a computer-generated world? I called up an expert and asked.
I'm Michael McDowell. I'm a NASCAR driver for Front Row Motorsports. And right now I race virtually, but normally I'm on the NASCAR circuit racing every Sunday.
So I want to take you back a little more than 4 weeks ago to March 13th. NASCAR had just canceled the race at Atlanta Motor Speedway. How soon did people start floating the idea of putting together an iRacing series?
You know, the idea got floated around pretty quickly, I'd say within that first week. People started talking about it. We were a little bit behind the ball. I didn't have a simulator or a rig set up ready to go at my house.
What did you have to do to get one set up?
Yeah, so it was a bit complicated just because by the time I got a hold of a couple of the manufacturers, they were already out of stock. And then a lot of, you know, as everybody knows, manufacturing of parts and pieces, a lot of that stopped. So we ended up building one at Front Row. My guys put together a chassis, and we were able to get parts and pieces shipped in from different areas and just built it at my house. And it's not the big motion, you know, triple, quadruple screens, but I got a nice monitor, nice set of pedals and wheels, and it's not as fancy as some of the other guys, but it does the job, and it's worked well.
Now, a network television first. A NASCAR All-Star race from the virtual Homestead Miami Speedway, delivered by iRacing.
So take me to the start of that first race. How were your nerves compared to what they would have been if you were sitting in an actual race car?
I think the nerves were about the same. My heart rate was about the same. So that kind of shows you just, you know, the anxiety level that you have. You know, just like anything, you want to do the best you can, and you don't want to make mistakes. And, you know, you still have people watching. And, yeah, so you don't want to go out there and spin out on the first lap and have your day be over. So without a lot of practice, I was pretty nervous. So I kind of eased into it. But now I think I feel fairly confident on there and comfortable, and you still get nerves and jitters, but it's not quite like, you know, strapping into a race car.
Jimmy, I guess the best part is it gives everybody a chance to have a little fun on Sunday afternoon, kind of forget about our troubles and our issues. The only thing looks like it gets hurt here are egos.
What's it like to be able to make contact with another car and know that there's no risk of injury? That's got to be kind of fun.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, we've seen some excitement for sure, even though we all take it very seriously. You know, when there's no consequences for running into each other or having crashes, you could really go for it and hang it all out.
Michael McDowell just doored McFliggerman.
He sure did.
And
you're not coming back to a shop of, you know, 50 people explaining why you destroyed the race car. You just hit the reset button, so you take more chances.
So cool to listen to that throttle, just like the real thing you see.
Now, I saw an interview where you said that racing at virtual Bristol is somewhat similar to racing at real Bristol, at least in terms of things like the difficulty in passing and that sort of thing. Have you been surprised by how similar iRacing is to the real thing?
Bristol was a great example of just how well they correlated as far as where the line was on the racetrack, how difficult was the pass, and the mental focus and the concentration that it took.
And the preferred lane definitely is this middle lane. They kind of run a high lane going into the center of the corner and then diming the corner and come off with the momentum.
You're still using all the the skills and techniques you would use to manipulate an actual NASCAR on the racetrack. It's just how you process it's a little bit different.
Denny Hamlin has been making the point that iRacing, unlike playing, I don't know, NBA 2K or Madden football, it can actually make you better at real racing. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something early on in my career that I did a lot of just because I didn't have experience at a lot of the tracks. I didn't even know what half the tracks looked like. So I was able to play them and get used to them and just get used to the surroundings and the different visual cues that you would use and look for and just an overall feel. I think iRacing actually allows you to focus on very small details, where in the race car you have an hour of practice and you got to make changes to the car. So the driver's not working on himself as much as he is working on the race car and trying to get the feel that he needs.
iRacing has been a huge success, setting records for TV viewership, creating a lot of social media buzz. Some teams, including yours, have signed new actual sponsors during their virtual drive time.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Really excited to announce the Celsius partnership. Celsius is going to be on board the 34 car this weekend at Bristol.
I think for a lot of fans, iRacing has been a really nice distraction, but it's almost also this sort of sense of normalcy in a world that's anything but normal. What has it meant to you to be able to keep at some semblance of your job during this time?
For me personally, it's just given me a goal, right? It's given me something that I need to do, and I want to be successful at it just like anything. So you got to put the time in during the week. And so just having something to look forward to, but also having something to fix your mind on that will, allow you to continue to improve. It's not ideal. Obviously, we all want to be back to normal life and doing our normal jobs. But for the meantime, it's helped pass some time, and it's been a lot of fun, and it's given us something to race.
Yeah, yeah. I have just one last question, and that's, now that my recording studio is here in my closet, I've been having a really hard time, separating myself from my work. Are you having trouble with that, too? Do you find yourself wanting to hop onto your sim at all times of the day?
Yes and no. I have four kids, so virtual learning has been harder than virtual racing, I can tell you that much. We're on spring break this week, which we're really happy about. I feel like a full-time IT guy just trying to get iPads and conferences up and figuring out how do you turn schoolwork in virtually and making sure everything gets done with the kids. So that part has kept me busy. In the afternoon, I'll hop on and do a little practice and maybe even get a couple of races in.
I think that there are a lot of people at home probably being like, yes, athletes have never been more relatable than they are right now.
Yeah, I think some of that is just the misperception, right? I've always been a dad of four, and I've always helped my kids with their schoolwork and homework. And I think it's just you're getting to see more of what life's like at home. But we're all pretty normal guys and girls, and just hoping that we get to go back to the racetrack soon.
Michael McDowell, thank you so much. This has really been fun.
Thank you.
Michael McDowell races for Front Row Motorsports. We spoke with him ahead of Sunday's race at Virtual Richmond. We'll have a link to all the virtual NASCAR action at onlyagame.org. Not every sport has the option to just go virtual. The XFL filed for bankruptcy this week after the COVID-19 pandemic forced the suspension of play just 5 games into the league's much-anticipated return. And the idea that fans will come back to their seats quickly and without reservation when sports do start up again took a hit last week when Seton Hall University released the results of a survey in which 72% of respondents say they won't return to live sporting events until there's a vaccine. Experts say that day is likely 12 to 18 months away. I'm joined by Dan Rasher, professor and director of academic programs for the sport management program at the University of San Francisco. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
And Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Hi, Ken.
Hey, it's really good to be here.
Okay, let's first talk about the study itself. It was a relatively small sample, just 762 respondents. They were asked 10 questions. Ken, was this a well-designed, well-executed survey?
Ooh, you're not going to get me to hate on an academic colleague. It is done as many surveys are. You know, how big can you get? If you could ask 330 million people in the country, that would be a much better path than asking 750 or 1250 or whatever the number might be. And really, I think more than anything else, the way the press put it out there might be what's most confusing to folks. If you're not a sports fan, you were saying that I'm not going back, but you were never there in the first place. So the real number the press should have had out there, I think, is 61% or something like that in terms of sports fans that said they would not come back.
Totally fair. So should we actually take people at their word when they say they won't return to sports venues until there's a vaccine?
You know, I've looked at these sorts of situations in the past. And if you think about the baseball strike a number of decades ago, fans were essentially saying the same thing, that they wouldn't come back. Now, that wasn't because of a health issue. That was because they were mad and they were going to take it out on the baseball teams and the players and the owners. And then in the end, of course, the research shows that they did come back. And we've seen that many situations where these surveys show that fans feel a certain way when they have to put their money where their mouth is. They actually tend to show up at these sporting events.
So, Ken, if it turns out that fans are saying one thing in a survey and another thing if their buddy says, hey, I've got front row seats for the NBA Finals, want to come, what do we make of the fact that what they say in the survey and what they do might not be the same?
People that are being surveyed answered the question honestly in the moment, I think, for the most part. I think people just don't know, you know, into the moment of truth, what the answer to many of these types of questions are going to be. And Dan's so right. You see this all the time. I'm so mad at the NFL players for striking 82. I'll never go back. And then, you know, it's now, you know, trying to be a $25 billion sport.
I mean, I do think this is a different situation. I think there's a lot more unknown here. I mean, there's a fear for people's health. And so that may be different. And I think, you know, answering honestly, as I sit in my room, am I going to go back? Am I going to be the first guy in the gate? Probably not. But of course, I will end up going back to sporting events. And I think that time lag, I think, is really what's going to be interesting, is how long will it take for people to fill those arenas.
Yeah. One of my colleagues got an email this week from something called the Ticketmaster Research Team asking what safety precautions she'd like to see at events once events have started up again. And from the questions she was asked, it sounds like the ticketing industry, and therefore probably the sports industry, is taking this study pretty seriously. Ken, should they be worried?
Oh, for sure. I think the timing is the big issue, and how rapidly people will come back. And, you know, I heard people down here in Phoenix, some of the people at the Diamondbacks and elsewhere, talking about, you know, hand sanitizers and visibly wiping seats down and the sorts of things that they're anticipating that they'll need to do to provide comfort and for genuine security for the fans. So, no, I think the industry is very wise to be mapping this out, and not just for the marketing PR standpoint, but also for real health.
Yeah, I think of a place like Fenway Park, which is a place I absolutely love. But man, those seats are small.
Yeah, there's not a lot of social distancing at Fenway. That's correct.
I mean, none of us know what's going to happen here. It's possible that the CDC will recommend that there be no fans at sporting events until there's a vaccine, in which case this whole conversation will likely have been kind of moot. But in the event that medical professionals tell us it's safe to go back, what does this poll tell you about what's actually going to happen next?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it is gradual, in the sense that in order to make people feel safe, a league decides to limit the capacity to, you know, half or a third of the number of seats. And maybe that would make people feel comfortable. And then you go a few weeks doing that, and those folks are not getting sick. Hopefully we have more testing by then. Then maybe they can start to open it up more.
Yeah, no, I'm there with Dan. And if you focus on the field of play, that's the other issue, and maybe even the dominant issue. So we've got ourselves a bit of a journey. But in the end, it will come back, you know, with the 1918 pandemic and all these other times. You know, we've come back with much less technology and much less medical wherewithal. And too, you know, I'm the 65-year-old guy. I am the last guy back in the stadium. I'm going to wait and see. I think it's demographic-based as well. I can see kids getting back out there pretty rapidly.
Let's talk just for a second about what's at stake here, because, you know, if there is a long layoff before fans get back in the stands, the NFL would probably be okay. But what about other leagues?
You mean like the XFL, for example?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem that we could see. The surprise there was, you know, we thought there was 3 years worth of funding, but you got to look to the funding source, which is the WWE, which wants to survive too. And if you can offload an expense, and the expense happens to be an entire league, that's the kind of thing that can happen. So we'll see. And it's all going to be a chain reaction kind of thing too. The media enterprises, will they continue to support sponsors? Will they support? So the fans are one segment, but there are a lot of dollars that come from a lot of different locations.
Yeah, exactly. And the major sports leagues have other sources of revenue. Maybe they'll come back if they can get the players and just earn media revenues for a bit and sponsor revenues before they fully earn ticket and concessions revenues and so forth. I mean, I'm worried about the minors. They don't really have much media revenue at all. And so they need fans in the stands. The hundreds of minor league teams out there, I wouldn't be surprised if many of them end up going under, or at least kind of, mothballing everything until every fan can come back in the gate, or they can at least draw a minimum number of fans.
Dan Rasher is the director of academic programs for the sport management program at the University of San Francisco. And Ken Shropshire is the CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen. Take care.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. The 1987 movie, The Princess Bride, begins with a situation that may feel familiar right now. Actor Fred Savage's character, the grandson, is stuck at home.
You feeling any better?
A little bit.
Then Peter Falk's character, the grandfather, shows up with a gift.
A book?
That's right. When I was your age, television was called books.
Is it got any sports in it?
Are you kidding? Fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes.
And I thought we stretched the definition of sports. Our next story doesn't have any fencing, fighting, or torture, but it is about the hot hand, the movie The Princess Bride, and a night that changed basketball. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
There was little reason to suspect that February 27th, 2013 would go down as a turning point in basketball history.
It was the middle of the dog days of the NBA season.
That's the Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen, who recently wrote a book called The Hot Hand. The New York Knicks were hosting the Golden State Warriors at Madison Square Garden.
And this is before the Warriors are who we think of them as now. And so this was just a regular old, boring regular season basketball game involving the New York Knicks, which, you know.
For those who may be unaware, the past two decades have not been kind to the New York Knicks. But there was something a bit unusual about this game for the Warriors. Golden State's all-star forward David Lee wouldn't be playing. The previous night against the Pacers, he'd gotten into a fight and he'd been suspended by the NBA. The Warriors would be missing Lee's 19 points per game against the Knicks.
Basically, their only offense was to unleash Steph Curry and hope that he got hot.
Steph Curry is now a global superstar, famous for taking and making bunches of three-pointers from all over the court. But back in February 2013, he wasn't even an all-star, and there was little reason to suspect that he was about to change the sport of basketball. Since his rookie season, Steph had been an absurdly accurate three-point shooter. But in other ways, his three-point shooting wasn't particularly remarkable. He wasn't taking all that many three-pointers, and most of the threes he did take were pretty standard. They weren't from far beyond the three-point line, and he was usually being set up off a pass from a teammate rather than creating a shot for himself off his dribble.
He was basically playing basketball the way that everybody had always imagined you should play basketball. He was boxed in by that imagination of basketball.
Steph Curry missed his first three-point attempt on February 27th, 2013 against the Knicks.
He doesn't make a three for the whole first quarter. It just looks like a normal game for him. And then what happens is that he makes one shot.
Curry with the quick trigger, got the three ball.
He makes another shot.
Curry with the quick three right down Main Street.
He's starting to feel good.
And this is where our story starts to become less about basketball and more about human psychology and a fierce academic debate. Because Steph Curry,
he begins to get a little bit crazier with the types of shots that he takes.
Midway through the second quarter, the Warriors got a steal, and Curry had the ball in transition.
He takes the ball on a fast break on a two-on-one, and for the entire history of basketball, what almost everybody in his situation would have done was continue to the basket for a layup or to create another three-pointer for his teammate. What he does instead is he stops behind the three-point line.
Steph Curry was going to shoot. Under ordinary circumstances, Curry's teammates might have considered this a bad shot. But Curry and everyone else in a Warriors uniform didn't believe these were ordinary circumstances.
They know that he is catching fire and they want to get him the ball because they think that he is hot.
Now, we're going to pause here and nerd out for a bit. Curry and his teammates, and basically every athlete, believe in something called the hot hand. The idea that after making a couple shots in a row, Curry actually becomes more likely to make his next one. Over decades, though, some academics have argued that there's actually no such thing as the hot hand, that the odds of Curry making a jump shot are fixed, like flipping a coin. Sometimes we might get lucky and get two heads in a row, but that doesn't mean the third flip is any more likely to come up heads. Scholars have looked for the hot hand, or this idea of being on a roll, beyond basketball.
So there was a paper published not too long ago by a statistical physicist named Dashen Wang, and he looked at what he called the hot hand periods of your careers. So not just basketball, in fact, not basketball at all, but he looked at Hollywood directors, and he looked at artists, and he looked at scientists. And what he wanted to know was, is creativity clustered? Like, do we have hits in our career that come before or after other hits? He looked at IMDb ratings for movies, and he looked at Google Scholar citations for scientists and auction prices for artists. And what he found was that in all three industries, if he knew what your best work is, chances are it's surrounded by your second and third best work, which is to say that there is this time in our career when we actually do elevate, when we have these hot hand periods. And so once I found out that movie makers had their own hot hands, I was sort of intrigued and I went looking for some.
And this is where we return to the Princess Bride.
Hold it, hold it. Where's the sports? Is this a kissing book?
In 1973, William Goldman's fantasy novel, featuring fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, and yes, a bit of kissing, was published. Over the next decade and a half, there were several attempts to turn the book into a movie.
Goldman liked to tell this story that studio heads would buy the rights to The Princess Bride and then get fired the next weekend. There was something haunted about The Princess Bride.
Yeah, and so why do you think people didn't want to make it right away? Why did it have so much trouble?
I think people have a hard time with things that push boundaries and that try to pack a lot of things into a little space.
It's almost like a deep three-point shot or something like that.
People thought that you shouldn't do it, and so people didn't do it. And yet, we now know that it probably makes a lot of sense to do it.
Who would be empowered to take an unconventional shot like that? Someone with a lot of talent, sure, but that apparently wasn't enough. Cinema all-stars Robert Redford, Norman Jewison, and Francois Truffaut had all tried and failed to make the movie. Ben Cohen thinks it had to be someone who also had the hot hand, someone who was really on a roll. Which brings us to director Rob Reiner.
If you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look.
Rob, in 1984, Reiner made his big screen directorial debut with This Is Spinal Tap, a mockumentary about a heavy metal band.
What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder.
These go to 11.
Now, it wasn't a commercial success until many years later, but it was a critical hit. People liked it, and that let him make another movie.
Reiner next made The Sure Thing and then Stand By Me.
I bet you anything that if we find him, we'll get our pictures in the paper.
It is a huge commercial hit at the box office. It's once again a critical smash.
Rob Reiner was on a roll, and he knew what he wanted to make next.
Rob Reiner puts all of his chips on the table, and he makes The Princess Bride.
Buttercup was raised on a small farm in the country of Florin. Our favorite pastimes were riding a horse and tormenting the farm boy that worked there.
He used the hot hand to make something that nobody else would have wanted him to make.
You sure no others follow us?
As I told you, it would be absolutely, totally, and in all other ways, inconceivable.
In basketball, we sort of have a word for this. It's called a heat check, right? A heat check is when you've made a few shots in a row and you kind of throw up a crazy shot, a risky shot.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
The Princess Bride was Rob Reiner's heat check.
And if The Princess Bride was Rob Reiner's heat check, it was a swish. The movie became a cult classic that's now on the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. And maybe, just maybe, a belief in the hot hand, or that any person can be on a roll, helped Rob Reiner finally get the unconventional film made. Now, getting back to February 27th, 2013, Steph Curry has hit 2 3-pointers in a row, and now he's got the ball on the fast break. He stops at the 3-point line and prepares to shoot. This, Ben Cohen says, was Steph Curry's heat check.
You can almost see this look of confusion on the face of the Knicks defender, because what Steph Curry was doing in that moment was so audacious.
The shot, of course, went in. He kept going.
Curry for the lead. Got it.
Curry. Oh, boy, sweet touch.
Come on.
Got it. What a night for Steph Curry.
Steph Curry finished with 54 points. Ben Cohen says most NBA superstars have a game where everything seems to click. But for Steph Curry, the difference between before and after February 27, 2013 is especially striking.
Before that game, Steph Curry in his career averaged 18 points on 5 3-point attempts per game. After that game, he's averaged 26 points per game on 10 3-point attempts per game. This is when things changed, when he was allowed to shoot the types of 3-pointers that nobody had ever been allowed to shoot before.
Regardless of whether or not the hot hand is real, and regardless of how significant the hot hand effect may really be, and you'll have to check out Ben Cohen's book to delve into all of that, at the very least, the fact that people believed in the hot hand helped empower Steph Curry to take the sorts of shots he'd always been capable of making. Since that night, Steph Curry has won 2 MVP awards, and NBA players are taking more 3-pointers than ever before. But there's actually one more reason why the night Steph Curry scored 54 points on the Knicks is noteworthy.
The most amazing part of this game is that the Knicks actually did win. Steph had the greatest scoring game of his career, and the Warriors lost to the New York Knicks.
I just have one thing to say to that. Inconceivable.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Ben Cohen's new book is The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Never, well, at least not in recent history, has the ability to step into the backyard to play a game of catch been more appreciated by more people. All you need is a ball and a glove and someone to play with. Marshall Galinsky has owned his baseball gloves since he was 11. That's 4 decades. But he didn't appreciate how well his lifelong mitt was constructed, or all that it represented, until recently. Here's Marshall.
The finest in the field. It says so right there on the glove, just below the part that's protected my pinky from hard-hit line drives and ill-advised outfield dives since about 1981. I'm not sure what role Andre Dawson had in its design, but practically every ball I've ever caught has come to rest just above his signature, branded into the leather that my father long ago slathered with linseed oil, wrapped in string, and stuffed under a mattress to break it in. So I've been using it more lately. My son is 11 now, and he wants to play catch a lot. That, together with Sundays playing Shul League softball for the past few summers, has kept the mitt and me young and pliable. Enough. When a piece of the lacing in the pocket tore this year, I tried to fix it with some dental floss. It ripped apart on the first catch. My efforts at repair were an affront to the mitt. Somewhere in America or Canada, Andre Dawson grimaced. Then, I happened upon the Dr. Glove Lacing Repair Kit at a local sporting goods store. $4.99. What could go wrong? Dr. Glove was plain spoken in his directions on the back of the package. Be sure to look carefully at the pattern of the lacing before taking it apart. Maybe it was the beers I'd consumed earlier, but after I pulled the lacing apart, I feared I would never get it back together. Dr. Glove's admonition was spot on. For all the time I'd spent pounding my fist and staring into that glove for the past four decades, I hadn't appreciated the leather lacing labyrinth around my fingers. For all those years, the mitt was so stable, so reliable, so dependable, and now it was a floppy-eared rabbit puppet. It was jello and leather. What have I done? Pulling the repair kit's leather laces through the mitt had released the smells of a thousand Little League games into my kitchen. The mitt must be saved. Its useful life, our aging selves, preserved. An hour or so later, the deed was done. The mitt is whole. All is right in the universe once again, and it's still the finest in the field.
Marshall Galinsky is a Boston area attorney who plays catch with his son in all seasons whenever asked. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, what do you do when you're writing a book about training for the Boston Marathon and the Boston Marathon is postponed? Run your own marathon, of course. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The XFL has filed for bankruptcy, citing the uncertainty of knowing when the pandemic will, quote, sufficiently abate as the cause of the league's demise. Are you sad to see it go again?
I'm not surprised. I mean, because it was going to struggle in the first years anywhere, and then it gets hit with this out of nowhere lightning bolt. It actually produced a product that people were willing to watch. So, yeah, I feel kind of bad about this.
The XFL is owned by Vince McMahon and his other enterprise, the WWE, and the WWE has been declared an essential business in Florida because Florida.
Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida, if it wasn't for the president, he would be reckoned to be the most reckless and irresponsible executive in all of American politics. But he knows which side of the bread is buttered. And Vince McMahon and his pack and his wife, who used to work for the Trump administration, are all very influential.
Well, just a few days after being declared an essential business in Florida, the WWE released a number of veteran performers and furloughed a portion of its workforce, again citing the COVID-19 pandemic as the reason for the cost-saving measures. Meanwhile, according to Forbes, Vince McMahon's net worth heading into the weekend was $1.9 billion.
Well, you think he would have been able to keep on a couple of secretaries anyway, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, this is an excellent opportunity for profiteering at a lot of different levels. And people who are inclined that way are taking advantage of it.
Live baseball is back, Charlie, as long as you don't mind watching the Rakuten Monkeys live on Twitter play games that start very, very early in the morning.
Lined into the gap, yep, in right center. Tom Tumway lays out
Jordan makes the grab.
Will you be tuning in?
I think the very, very early in the morning part is what's going to keep me from turning in, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, if you're a baseball fan, that's what you got right now. So the Rakuten Monkeys are your ball club. And by the way, the Rakuten Monkeys, they're going to sell a lot of gear in the United States.
Boy, are they. The league is called the Chinese Baseball Professional League. Games are being played in empty stadiums. And officials in Taiwan say they've been able to resume play because they were very good early on at slowing the spread of the virus. I am no medical expert, but I do wonder if it's a good idea to tempt fate like this.
Yeah, considering we don't know a lot about the virus yet, but, you know, it's interesting to watch the empty stadium experiment get a public test.
Although, you know, some baseball stadiums are so regularly empty that it doesn't seem as odd as maybe a football game would.
Well, no, that's not a kind thing to say about the Florida Marlins, Karen, in this difficult time.
Here in the U.S., the only pro baseball is virtual pro baseball, where major leaguers play each other on the video game version of the sport called MLB The Show. And so far, the star of the show has been Texas Rangers slugger Joey Gallo, who won his first 9 games. Any chance this performance will help Joey the next time his real-life contract is up?
I don't think management is likely to apply your virtual skills to actual baseball. If that happens, then we're all doomed. I mean, once virtual sports and real sports are declared equal in our minds, we're all in trouble.
Once again, virtual NASCAR has had real-world consequences. Driver Kyle Larson was suspended for using a racial slur during an unofficial virtual race. Larson has also lost sponsorships. Ironically, Larson came up through NASCAR's Drive for Diversity program. He's the only driver of Japanese descent to win a major NASCAR race. What do you make of all this?
I think that's unfortunate. I think NASCAR did the right thing, but if you want an embarrassing way to get suspended, this is it.
Yeah. Patrick Mouratoglou, better known as Serena Williams's coach, is calling on the governing bodies of tennis to help lower level players. Those are people who earn a living solely on tournament winnings, who are struggling financially due to the coronavirus pandemic. It really should be noted that lower level players struggle financially even when there's not a global shutdown. So maybe they can work on fixing that at the same time.
Yeah, these are the players who struggle to pay for their own travel, to pay their own coaches. And what passes for their salary depends on how many matches they win. It's a razor's edge kind of life. And I think, you know, while everyone's trying to fix everything, you know, under the umbrella of the coronavirus, this is something that certainly deserves to be looked at.
And finally, Charlie, in this world without sports, I've found the sports hero we all need. Take a listen. That's Gritty, the official mascot for the Philadelphia Flyers, bouncing a ping pong ball off various household items and into a cup. And I don't think I've ever been more entertained.
First of all, Gritty is a national hero. You know, we accept that as a truism.
And who cares if it took him like a whole week to get those shots in? You know,
You don't think it was one time only?
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
I can't guarantee that it will be quite as entertaining as watching a giant orange mascot bounce ping pong balls off of pots and pans, but we at Only a Game are doing our best to bring you great stories, even during this pandemic. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever they're keeping the podcasts these days. While you're there, leave us a review. That would be swell. And thanks. The Tour de France has been rescheduled for August, but that doesn't mean athletes aren't snapping into their pedals to compete, though they may not be the athletes you're expecting.
Hey guys, Bubba Watson here. Hey, I've been in the house for a while, and we all know it's not fun. It's stressful, but I got on the Peloton bike. I need to relieve some stress.
With golf courses kind of being deemed non-essential, tour pros are having to find ways to stay active and competitive.
That's Jonathan Wall. He's the managing editor for equipment at Golf Magazine and Golf.com.
You hop on a spin bike and you can race against fellow tour pros. You know, this is kind of a way for the elite players, especially, to kind of scratch that competitive itch.
Recently, Jonathan got a chance to scratch a competitive itch of his own. And by doing so, he learned something about his own athletic ability. It all started on March 24th, 12 days after PGA pros were sent home in the middle of the Players' Championship.
Friday morning, Justin Thomas said he's in with me. Friday morning, 9 o'clock Central, so I'm not sure what time for y'all, but let's all ride together, get fit together, relieve some stress together. Let's do it. Come on. Here we go.
We do a daily Zoom call like a lot of other companies. One of our social media editors, she said, hey, does anybody happen to have a Peloton? And there was this silence. And I thought, I guess I'm the only one who has one. So I kind of just said, yeah, I've got a Peloton. And she says, Justin Thomas and Bubba Watson, who are two of the bigger names on the PGA Tour, are going to be doing a Peloton ride. Do you want to hop on and just kind of chronicle it? And so I said, yeah, sure, why not? I've always been an active guy. Love being outdoors, love playing golf, basketball, skiing. I'm not an athlete, but I definitely train and exercise just to stay healthy. I thought, you know what? It's just fun. I'm going to ride with these guys. And then I found out that Rory McIlroy was in the group, and that really kind of upped the motivation for me.
So why? What's the big deal? Why is Rory the guy everyone wants to beat?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to the Players' Championship, which is the PGA Tour's flagship event.
Glad to be back. Obviously, it was, this week last year was huge for me in terms of...
There have been rumors going around that Rory was the Peloton king on the PGA Tour, and he was just cranking out output numbers that you know, professional rider cyclists would probably be proud of. Shane Ryan, who writes for Golf Digest, he happened to just ask, you know, Rory, are the numbers real? And Rory kind of just admitted, yeah, like I am pretty good at the Peloton.
Billy, JT, Charlie, I beat you again.
He goes on social media and, you know, he'll like poke fun at some of his other, you know, playing competitors. I mean, they openly try to beat Rory on the Peloton. Like, it's a big deal. When you're the number one, he's the number one golfer in the world. When you're number one, everybody's chasing you. And so even in the Peloton arena, pro golfers are trying to dethrone the Peloton King.
Okay, so set the scene for me. It's the morning of this ride.
Yep, so my Peloton is located in the upstairs of our house. We have a workout room. It's kind of one of those things where I'm actually a little bit nervy, which is crazy because I hop on the Peloton on a very regular basis.
Am I going to get lapped on the road like it would off the tee? Let's find out.
And I hop on the Peloton and I open up the class and it was like, okay, I'm going to go out. I'm going to try and beat Rory.
Let's snap in and go.
It's pretty quick. Once you click start on a class, you have, you know, probably about a minute to just kind of warm your legs up. And then they do about a 4 to 5 minute warm up where you really start to ramp up the speed and the resistance if you want.
All right. Alex Toussaint, 30 minute ride. Legs going. Here we go.
Is there a soundtrack? Is there an instructor screaming at you? How does it go?
There is definitely an instructor screaming at you. Although I will admit that it's usually me screaming. It's usually about midway through the ride where I will get really angry and question why I'm on this darn bike.
All right. Nearly halfway through. Starting to look a little bit darker than the original color. No big deal. Let's keep going.
As you're on this bike looking at this digital screen, it has a whole bunch of output numbers. So it has a digital leaderboard where it shows you kind of where you stand based on your output. And the output is a combination of your resistance. And then you also have your cadence, which is how fast you're going. So I usually swipe the leaderboard away and I just look at the cadence, the resistance, and my total output. That's it. As I was riding against Justin Thomas and Bubba and Rory, the Peloton King, I had no idea where I stood the entire race until the end.
All right. So when did you finally give in to the temptation to look?
So I will admit it was very difficult. I really wanted to peek, and it wasn't until probably within the last like minute of the ride where I took a look at the leaderboard and I had PR'd, which is a personal record. And I figured like, wow, I'm racing Rory and I'm putting out numbers that I've never put out before.
And as you can tell by my heavy breathing, that's a wrap. 30 minutes, a lot of fun. Didn't see JT or Bubba, but
when you hear you're riding with Justin Thomas and Bubba Watson and Rory McIlroy, people think, well, do you get to see them? Like, are there like videos? Thankfully, there's not, because nobody wants to see me dripping in sweat, screaming at an instructor. So I had to go in and check on where Rory was. And I actually scrolled up and down the leaderboard first. And I figured, even though I had a great ride, I'm like, he had to beat me. And I scrolled all the way to the top and I didn't see him. And I thought, I must have missed him. And so I scrolled down and then it was like, oh my goodness, I beat Rory.
So I'm sure everybody wants to know how I finished up. Oh, look at that. Number 58 out of 10,000. Not bad for a golf rider.
Even if he beats me again, I can still tell him, well, I still beat you that one time, and I actually beat him pretty handily.
Now, I don't want to diminish what you've done, but is there any chance Rory was just having a bad day?
It's definitely possible. I don't know any other area in sports where a average person can compete against the best in the world. You're never going to get a chance to play Rory on the golf course in a competitive setting. This is the closest thing you're going to get. I actually saw Roger Federer is on Peloton and he's putting up insane numbers. People always say he's kind of in the twilight of his tennis career. Not on the Peloton.
Can you beat Roger Federer?
I know, no chance. Why don't they do like a Peloton tournament and seed them like 1 through 64 pro athletes and let them go head to head and crown a Peloton king throughout all sports? I think it's a great idea. I would love it. Do it for charity. Maybe I can put a bug in somebody's ear and they'll get it going.
That's Jonathan Wall, managing editor for equipment at Golf Magazine and Golf.com. We'll have a link to his original story at onlyagame.org. And Rory McIlroy, if you're listening, Jonathan's up for a rematch whenever you'd like. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.